With Truth News Radio Australia on Friday the 6th of August 2010. My name's Heroid Fenton and I've got a show here that is a homegrown show from Australia that brings you news, current events from a truth perspective, a truther perspective, inspired by many people around the world who have questioned various things that have been deemed as given truths from government, from media, from the corporatized reality that we are living in this age. And what we do on this show is we attempt to give you the other side of the coin from a perspective of scientific rigor as well as philosophical values that are related to what we believe is important, like freedom, the freedom of choice, freedom of the individual, the core principles of truth and democracy and human rights. And we always find, like every week, there is so much to talk about because there are so many stories that build up through our network in this time that we're living in, where we're basically confronted with so many assaults on basic human freedom and human values. So it's just our job, unfortunate job in some ways, to go through some rather unpleasant material, some gut-wrenching facts. But in doing so, my belief is that we can actually provide ultimate a sense of liberation from the mental stranglehold that the corporate media and the corporatist oligarchy has on our souls. So with that, I'll just move straight into the stories for tonight. Peace. We have voices. Okay, well, I'm going to lead with a story from New York because earlier this week, the U.S. Senate voted on a bill that was to give a large amount of money to the 9/11 first responders. And unfortunately, that bill was repealed in the U.S. Senate. And we have some footage here of actually a comedian, John Stewart, who's kind of one of those satirical comedians who, and we've actually, I've also got some other material lined up for later as well from George Carlin, and these guys really take satire and political comment right up to the wire, and quite often I think it really is more direct political comment. And this is really an excellent example of, I think, John Stewart at his acerbic best. So I'm just going to play a short clip here. I just got a short article to go with it from 9/11 blogger website, 911blogger.com. Many of us remember how John Stewart took on the financial industry after a not-so-well-thought-out burst of opinion by CNBC's Rick Santelli on the floor of the CME. It led to many discussions around the water cooler, and the mainstream media elite had to send out a veteran crony to try and smooth things out before some real truths about our financial system surfaced to the public consciousness. With any luck, John Stewart's admonishment of our pathetic and spineless Congress in not passing the Zegroda 9/11 first responder healthcare bill will have the same effect. Here it is in case you missed it.
Welcome to The Daily Show. My name is John Stewart. Thanks for joining us. My guest tonight Not sure what that was, but I'm assuming it's anti-Semitic. My guest tonight, author Bruce Henderson, wrote a book about one of the great escapes of the Vietnam War. I'm not talking about Cheney's five deferments. Boom! Boom! Actually, he's been out of office for a couple of years and apparently in the hospital, so... Sorry. Let's begin tonight in Washington. You know, as you know, we talk a lot on this program about how Congress can be somewhat ineffectual or short-sighted or ignorant or a fetid pool of corruption and stupidity located at the intersection of Entitlement Avenue and Abject Dereliction of Duty Lane. I'm sorry, what are we talking about again? Congress. All right. Credit where credit is due. Last week, the House of Representatives took up a pressing issue with bipartisan support.
Today is an important step towards ensuring that the appropriate resources are available to take care of those who risk their lives to save others on September 11th.
Mr. Speaker, our committee can do great work when we work together.
Yes, we can. And what better reason to work together than on a bill providing health care for 9/11 first responders and relief workers currently suffering chronic health problems directly related to their brave service. It's one of Congress's finest hours. But I'm sorry, sir, I cut you off. Continue.
Mr. Speaker, our committee can do great work when we work together. This is not one of our finest times.
Hey, what the, what? Are you objecting to this bill? How? Why? What? Wet? Wicker? Wah? Yes, apparently this story now falls under the rubric of our brand new segment, I Give Up. All right. Naysayers. Let's hear why you're against it.
The legislation has been paired with a fundamentally flawed and job-destroying tax increase, and therefore I will vote against it.
Oh! Oh, there's a tax increase to pay for this. I'm sorry, I didn't know they were going to try and pay for the bill to provide health care for those suffering for their heroism with a tax. My guess is it must be an incredibly reprehensible and onerous tax to cancel out your willingness to have such a fine program. Is it a tax on, I don't know, babies? Is it a fine for acts of kindness? Is it a tariff on parents who allow their children to retain their virginity past the age of 14? For I, too, would reject such a measure. Or is this tax actually just the closing of a loophole to prevent, quote, foreign multinational corporations incorporated in tax haven countries from avoiding tax on income earned in the United States? Translation, your P.O. box on Grand Cayman Island ain't fooling anybody, Jack. My guess is Representative Camp found himself decamped, even from his own colleagues on this one.
Going through that rubble and their heroism themselves, they went there to save survivors, not to raise taxes.
You fill my heart with sadness. I mean, if they had... I guess if 9/11 responders had known taxes might be raised because of their heroism, well, I imagine there would have been quite a different scene on 9/11. All right, there's people stranded on the 89th floor, but before I rush in, you gotta promise me, McCluskey, you gotta promise me and my family that this will not affect the Swiss pharmaceutical company's offshore tax status. You gotta promise me that. Or I'm not going in there. You're an ass.
Okay, I'll just pause it there. We'll put that up on our show notes. It goes on for a bit longer. It really gets quite heated, and it really starts to border on... You know, John Stewart's style there, his humor is always on a knife edge, but he really just gets outright quite angry during that, and it still manages to come across as humor, actually. And the point here, of course, very clear. The 9/11 responders, although they have received some settlements after years, there was some payments that were actually authorized. But this was actually a bill that was, and through the Congress, and I think I said incorrectly Senate, thinking in Australian terms earlier. This was a bill which would really take care of them. And it's almost 10 years since the event, and the health effects from the people who suffered were known years and years ago. It's nothing new. This would have been finally some serious financial remuneration, which has just been chucked out. Quite rightly there, John Stewart has shown highlighted the absurdity and the criminality of these people. So, I do encourage you to listen to the whole piece. Okay, just want to move on to an interesting article from last couple of days from writer Michelle Chosadovsky, who writes for the Canadian site globalresearch.ca. The title of the article is Preparing for World War III Targeting Iran. Now, Michelle Chosadovsky has written extensively about this, and this goes back many years because the threats against Iran go back to really the heels of the Iraq invasion. There was talk of attacking Iran. We have a cycle of kind of building it up, and then it wanes, and then they build it up again. We're kind of currently on a build-up cycle again. And I'll just read you a few paragraphs here from the article by Michelle Chosadovsky. Humanity is at a dangerous crossroads. War preparations to attack Iran are in an advanced state of readiness. High-tech weapon systems, including nuclear warheads, are fully deployed. This military adventure has been on the Pentagon's drawing board since the mid-1990s. First Iraq, then Iran, according to a declassified 1995 U.S. Central Command document. Escalation is part of the military agenda. While Iran is the next target together with Syria and Lebanon, this strategic military deployment also threatens North Korea, China, and Russia. Since 2005, the U.S. and its allies, including America's NATO partners and Israel, have been involved in the extensive deployment and stockpiling of advanced weapons systems. The air defense systems of the U.S., NATO member countries, and Israel are fully integrated. This is a coordinated endeavor of the Pentagon, NATO, Israel's Defense Force, with the active military involvement of several non-NATO partner countries, including the frontline Arab states, members of NATO's Mediterranean Dialogue and the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, Saudi Arabia, Japan, South Korea, India, Indonesia, Singapore, Australia, and among others. Another 21 countries are members of the Euro-Atlantic Partnership Council. So we have here a pretty serious situation, folks, with the ramping up of anti-Iran rhetoric. And the article here is quite in-depth, and it goes through many different subject areas: war and the economic crisis, media disinformation, the cult of killing and destruction. The global killing machine is sustained by an embedded cult of killing and destruction, which pervades Hollywood movies, not to mention the primetime war and crime TV series on network television. This cult of killing is endorsed by the CIA and the Pentagon, which also support and finance Hollywood productions as an instrument of war propaganda. And on that note, I've got a really interesting clip I'm going to play from a new movie that's just come out, which really I've found to be one of the most obnoxious things I've seen, and I've seen a lot of really bad stuff. But this new movie, starring Samuel L. Jackson, is an a shameless piece of disgusting, absolutely disgusting propaganda. Anyway, we'll get onto that in a minute. But I do recommend this article, and we'll put that on our show notes along with everything else. Coalition to dump internet filter. Well, this is a small piece of good news. The Australian internet censorship debate has reached another interesting sort of point, you know, kind of poised again with the election coming up and the government receiving so much pushback on their plans to put in the filter. The coalition has now come out pretty conclusively and said that they are going to block it, which means that even if Labor gets up, even if all of the other measures to basically oppose what they're doing don't work, the coalition, and I certainly hope that we can trust them on this, has vowed to vote against the filter. So we know, of course, that the coalition in the past has actually wanted to bring in a filter of their own, and even as recently as the last term of John Howard's government, they had plans on the books to bring in a filter. So, you know, because we don't live in a true democracy where you actually do have really robust opposition and, you know, groups and political parties, I can't feel totally confident about this. But what I would say is that this latest development is a sign that the groundswell of public opinion here, which basically is on the side of the basic human rights and understanding that this is a basic invasion and intrusion on freedom of speech, regardless of how they package it, regardless of how they, you know, how they tarnish anyone who questions it with the label of, you know, child porn and stuff, you know, we know what it basically is. We know what it's used for in other countries. We know what censorship has always been used for. And yes, child pornography is terrible. It's horrific. Okay. But we know what censorship is used for, right? Censorship is always used to suppress dissenting voices in a society. So the deceitful little double game that's been played here has been seen through by the vast majority of people. And the opposition party here in Australia is responding to that. But of course, when they get government, if they do attain government, we may find that they flip flop. So again, the battle here is not over. It's just the war is not over. We've won, I think, a battle here, and that's, you know, due to the massive you know, groundswell against the internet filter that we did see through many different groups. Okay, I've got a quirky little video here I'd like to play in relation to Bill Gates. And this is a topic that has been kind of going around the blogs and the truther circles for the last few months after Bill Gates made a rather bizarre statement during a lecture at one of the TED forums, in which he said that you know, his goal is to achieve population reduction, and that's well known and uncontroversial that he wants to do that. But the way he said he was going to go about doing it was, he actually said that he was going to, you know, the way he wants to assist this is to bring in a lot of vaccination campaigns, and he basically said, and his exact words were something like, you know, By bringing in these vaccinations and, you know, making vaccination universal, we will actually lower the population. And a lot of people, you know, truthers and whatnot, were quite you know, amazed to hear him say this, because it seemed to almost be like an admission of the secret plan that many people believe is in place to actually use vaccines as sterilization technology, basically. And of course, it's quite feasible to do that. It's quite easy to engineer a vaccine to basically sterilize people or even kill people if you wanted to. But it did seem to be a little bit surprising. And I want to play you here a clip from a kind of grassroots, just a homegrown vlog blog from Canada called The Truther Girls. And it's kind of humorous, and we've got more humor coming up for tonight. So I think this is in the vein of tonight's show. And she basically breaks down what Bill actually said and tries to make some sense of it. And it doesn't really come out making much sense, but it's definitely worth a listen. It's quite amusing.
Okay, Bill Gates is an open advocate of depopulation. He's pretty open about that. And he's also an open advocate of vaccines. And recently at a TED conference, he basically said that through using vaccines, as well as improved healthcare and reproductive health, which means abortion, you could reduce the population growth. So a lot of websites have seized on this to say, aha, the vaccines are sterilizing people.
And Bill Gates used vaccines to lower population. And here you can watch the TED video for yourself.
Okay, here's what he actually said. The world today has 6.8 billion people. That's heading up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, and reproductive health services, abortion, we could lower that by perhaps 10 to 15%.
Okay, this is the Gavi website. Our mission to save children's lives and protect people's health by increasing access to immunization in poor countries. Alliance members include Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And this is what they say, our global health strategies. Our efforts in global health aim to harness advances in science and technology to save lives in developing countries. We work with partners to deliver proven tools such as vaccines, drugs, and diagnostics, and to invent new solutions where they don't exist. We invest heavily in vaccines across our portfolio in the hope that one day they can be used to prevent HIV, malaria, and TB, wipe out polio, and help save children from dying of diarrhea and pneumonia. Okay, so as you can see, Gavi and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are all about vaccines. But let's let Bill Gates explain himself about how he figures that vaccines are going to reduce the population without being used to sterilize people. He says, well, the most exciting thing I've learned when I was just getting into philanthropy was that if you reduce childhood deaths, you improve health in a society that, surprisingly, population growth goes down. And that's because a parent needs to have some children survive into adulthood to take care of them when they're old. And so if they think having six children is what they need to do to have at least two survive, that's what they'll do. And amazingly, across the entire world, as health improves, then the population growth is actually is reduced. You don't have to have six children to end up with two, because that would be a 75% child mortality rate. And we don't have that. Even in the countries with the highest child mortality rates, such as Mali. 1990 in Mali, it was 25, and now it's gone down to about 19%. So by reducing child mortality, women will have fewer children, and that's going to reduce population growth. You have 25% of children under five die in Mali. You vaccinate them all, this solves the problem. None of them die, or very few of them die. And then you're going to have a 25% decline in population growth. So if you have a 25% decline in the birth rate and 25% fewer children die, then you end up at the same place. So you'd have to reduce the population growth.
Anyway, look, she's quite got a sense of humor, this girl. And the Truth of Girls is a vlog that you can go onto on YouTube, and you can watch a lot of stuff that they do. It's quite interesting. Yeah, so look, I had a bit of trouble following that, and I think I'm going to have to listen to it a few more times to try and figure out what is actually really going on there. And indeed, the question here is, you know, well, okay, Bill Gates is saying that he wants to lower the population, but he wants to do it by making people more healthy. Now, there is just aside from the minutiae of the you know, the questions of how that would play out, there's something slightly wrong there, isn't there? Because, I mean, if you make people more healthy, you make them live longer, are you going to reduce the population? Well, you know, as she points out, well, the claim is that, yes, they're going to have smaller families because they don't need to have so many kids. But then the numbers there don't quite add up either. So anyway, definitely worth a look. And we'll move on now with some more stuff. Leave it in. Okay, here we go. Hang on. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, well, at this point, it is my great pleasure to welcome to the show our guest for tonight, who's going to be going through some really interesting musical journey with us. After I get through the rest of the mountain of news, I have to climb up. And this is Lawrence McDonald, who has been on the show once before. Lawrence, welcome to Truth News Radio.
Hi, Herwood. Great to be here.
Yeah, look, it's great to have you back on. It's been a while since you've been on the aboard the ship of truth, but... it's always great to have you you with us, and it's, I always enjoy having new guests on the show. And tonight you'll be taking a look at a bit of a musical journey for us. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I have to, in the time available, just talk about a couple of artists this time, just to sort of talk about their common points and maybe point up a couple of interesting things about them.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, you've got pretty good knowledge of a few musical genres there, and you know, I would like to actually get more into that at a later stage. Maybe we'll do a few shows on it. But look, in the meantime, you're going to be sitting in co-pilot seat here because there's quite a few stories I need to get through, and you know, you're welcome to interject. We welcome interjection on Truth News Radio. Interjection is our lifeblood. You know, if you disagree or otherwise, and I should just get your opinion on the previous segment there about Bill Gates and the vaccines. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, it's. Just from what you said, like I can't get an idea of the full picture, but yeah, it's a real sort of window into what's probably happening at the higher echelons these days when you hear something like that. Population growth, etc., is what is constantly what you hear on people's minds and has been for a while, and what the reality of you know, population projections and impact and those kind of things is really sensitive stuff. And, you know, you just have to be interested in what everyone's got to say about it, basically.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, what, you know, many concerned citizens, I guess, have said is that certainly, you know, we want to be good stewards of the planet. We don't want to, obviously, you know, be a burden on the planet's resources, but at the same time, we don't really want to get into a situation where the objective seems to be to drastically cull the human population. And I'm not a believer in that. See, 'cause I actually think that we can go a lot. We can accommodate a lot more people on this planet, and I don't sort of have that view of human beings as livestock. And I guess that's that's the difference between me and your average billionaire, right? Because I think your average billionaire, because there's such a differential in terms of their power and wealth to the vast masses of people, they do look upon us as livestock.
That's right. I mean, when you consider that you could fit the entire Earth's population into an area the size of probably
Texas.
Yes, that's right.
In fact, Texas. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. So we're talking about resource use. It's not really an issue of population. It's an issue of resource use and therefore of culture, because those two are, you know, traditionally associated, and as far as anyone else can work out, you know, inextricable. And so it's a question of this. These other issues, it's like using, what are you going to use for energy? What are you going to use for power? How are you going to organize your people, etc.? But it doesn't mean that the first thing you come up with is culling people. No, that's the last thing you'd come up with. Yeah.
Indeed. And, you know, as we are, you know, men of the people, we are, you know, we don't see ourselves as being some sort of lofty elite sitting in a kind of like a control room observing the game park, you know, and working out, you know, which animals, you know, need to be culled down or brought up. We're all in this together, but the difference there is with these super rich, super powerful people, and they are the ones that are working on these global population schemes. You'll find it's always been that. It goes back to the Rockefeller family, the Carnegie, the eugenics movement back in the 1920s and 30s, which of course inspired Hitler, always wanting, basically seeing humanity as something that they can just basically control and regulate to get the right balance of what they want. They're welcome to keep on trying, and we're going to keep on bringing them down. That's all I can say, is as best we can. Yeah. Now, I just want to point out a new movie. It's actually not that new. It's been around for at least a year, but it's new to me. And the title of the movie is The New American Century. And the film was made by Massimo Mazzucco. And it is about the post-9/11 world. It gets into a lot of questions about 9/11, but in such a way that it doesn't so much explore the 9/11 conspiracy theories. It more or less takes those for granted. It's really looking at the overall geopolitical plans that within which 9/11 fits like a hand in a glove. And I haven't actually had a chance to watch the whole movie, but I'll just give you a short review here that was written by John Bursell, who's a regular on this show. He says here that if you really want to know who did 9/11, this film, The New American Century, does a great job at setting out both who called for it and who benefited from it. While this production is successful in confronting deeply disturbing recent American and world history, its greatest achievement is that it presents the real and clear message that the American neocons are in control of our world at war today. It makes the case indirectly that their control will continue to be a reality until the real history of the events on September 11th, 2001 are confronted by the American public. So, it actually, I think, was made prior to the inauguration of Obama. So it really, it has that atmosphere of the Bush regime, the Bush era. And a lot of people might look at it and go, oh, well, it's, you know, it's all gone now. It's all over because we've changed. But then I think people might have said that a year ago, you know, in the first 6 months of Obama's presidency. But now a year later, what we've seen with Obama is that apart from the rhetoric and apart from the, the veneer of a more civilized approach, we have business as usual when it comes to war. And, we have a staged pullout from Iraq, but of course there's still massive military commitments there, which they don't really talk about because they've got that huge embassy there and they've got, you know, huge numbers of private security there, which is a kind of another underground arm of the imperial military machine. And then, of course, we've got the escalation in Afghanistan and the incursions into Pakistan, which showed, really clearly demonstrate that the military machine that was unleashed by the neoconservatives is still well on track. I mean, there's really hardly, it hasn't faltered. I mean, I'm sure that Dick Cheney would look at what's going on at the moment and give an approving nod, wouldn't you say, Lawrence?
Yeah, well, you could be right because, you know, a lot of that same momentum is still in place and you know, the fact that they're supposed to be pulled out by, I think, the 10th of August was the official policy, is a long time coming because up till now it's just been exactly pretty much the same policy as during the Bush era, except that, you know, they have to immediately cut costs. So that seems to be the only thing that's actually changing any of the other decision making in Afghanistan and Iraq, by the look of it.
Indeed. So, yeah, keep your eye on the ball there because things are moving, you know, pretty fast. And with this whole Iran situation and the escalation of the rhetoric, you know, of hostility, it doesn't look good. So we're gonna keep talking about that on this show, that's for sure. Now, I've got a really important news piece to play for you now, and this is actually something that just came to my desk in the last couple of days, and it's actually from a mainstream news in Australia. I think it was on Channel 7, and it's all about fluoride. And some of you, many listeners to this show, we've done shows on it, and many people have been aware of that there are problems, but it's always seemed that, oh, well, you know, there's no experts acknowledging it. Well, that's actually quite untrue. There's a number of good stuff out there on the internet, good videos and presentations by qualified people. And it turns out that the only countries that actually fluoridate their water now are Australia, the US, Canada and the UK. Europe has largely stopped doing it, and most other countries in the world don't do it. And anyway, I'll just play to you this this piece, which as I say, aired on Australian primetime television within the last week.
With the reassurance from our health authorities that it is doing us good. The truth is, fluoride is a poison, and adding it to our drinking water is an evolving social experiment started 40 years ago. Now one of the world's top fluoride experts has issued a grim warning about what it could be doing to our health and that of unborn children. Yet as Frank Pengello reports, you'll get a different spin from dentists and health bureaucrats.
We consider that as a poison. Why should a poison be in drinking water?
The poison is fluoride. It's there because government health bureaucrats and dentists tell us it's for our common good, for reducing tooth decay, and at levels which won't harm you. That doesn't wash with Professor A.K. Shashila.
They should realise it's the poisonous substance. It doesn't promote health. It is a disease-causing agent, and the fluoridation should be stopped as early as possible.
Professor Shashila is one of the world's leading experts on fluoride. Her own extensive research, along with 70 years of data in India, backs up what she's saying, and it's most disturbing.
I would consider a pregnant mother taking fluoride-contaminated products. I'm using the word products, which includes water, toothpaste, black tea, processed food products, which has fluoride.
Any liquid.
Anything where her urinary fluoride is high, she is going to cause a lot of damage to the fetus, the growing embryo, the infant which is going to be born.
The American Dental Association warns against using fluoridated water to mix baby formula. Not so here.
They don't read. They are not aware. They don't update themselves. They don't do any research. So we are in a serious problem.
Professor Shashila says exposure to fluoride could also be the cause of many ills like neck, shoulder and joint pains, which may be misdiagnosed by doctors. She routinely does urine tests to check fluoride levels in her patients.
Remove the fluoride ingestion, starting from toothpaste, black tea, fluoridated water, whatever, and you bring down the urinary fluoride to normal limits, the patient recovers.
Fluoride is also used as a preservative and also lurks in many products we consume. But apart from toothpaste, it's not listed on labels.
So it is coming into one's body through many sources, and you are not aware of it.
The fluoride that goes into our drinking water is toxic waste from the production of fertilizer.
For maybe 100 years, the phosphate fertilizer industry put out two very, very poisonous gases into the environment, hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride. Eventually, they were required to capture those, and they did it with a wet spray, water, and that water converts these two very toxic gases into hexafluorosilicic acid. And it's this scrubbing liquor, which is about 25% strong, is put into tanker trucks, driven around the country, and added to our drinking water.
I'll just leave it there. Yeah, hexafluorosilicic acid. That's what we're getting, folks. And, I tell you, look, for me, if I wanted to have that, you know, and I think anyone who wants it should be able to have it. I would certainly be the last to want to deny anyone that chemical if they want to take it. But to have it mass medicated, to have it prescribed to all of us, one size fits all, in the drinking water, seems to me something I don't really agree with. And even if it was good for me, I don't think I'd agree with it, because I don't think it should just be a one size fits all. Just throw it in the drinking water. I mean, we don't throw vitamin C in the drinking water when we know that's good for you. And of course, there have been ideas tossed around even recently. And believe it or not, this is really true, that it might be good to throw a bit of lithium in the water to improve people's mood, environmental proponents of population reduction have John Holdren, who is a co-author of EcoScience and is a key advisor to Obama, had proposed putting sterilants in the water supply to control populations. So, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, It is our water is like the most important, you know, thing that we have, our most important single resource, and we want it to be clean, we want it to be fresh, we want it to be pure. And if we want to have a bit of fluoride, we can always add it ourselves. So look I'm going to move on now, because I've got a couple more really interesting things to talk about. Okay, I want to move on now to discuss a review a film, but I don't want to dignify it by calling it a review, because the film is just an obnoxious piece of rubbish. But I want to talk about it a little, and I want to play you a clip from it. It's a film that I had the misfortune of actually watching when I was bored one night. I downloaded it, and it stars Samuel L. Jackson, who's a pretty respected actor in a lot of films, and it certainly was aiming at a big market there, although it didn't do very well, and it went straight to video. It didn't actually hit the cinemas, so that's a sign of the fact that the distributors probably didn't think it was too good. But I think that the material in this film, and it probably will be in your video store soon, if not already. The title of the film is Unthinkable. And the film is about something which we would consider unthinkable. And guess what it is? Any guesses? Any guesses there, Lawrence, as to what the subject matter might be?
Unthinkable.
Yeah.
No.
Remember, it's a political thriller focusing on terrorism.
Could it be the fact that there might have been government input into 9/11?
I wish it was along those lines. Unfortunately, no. The unthinkable topic that they that is the whole focus of the film is actually torture, of course, but torture itself, as we know, is quite normalized now. So that's not really unthinkable, is it? There's actually some other aspect to this. What could it be? It's torture and. What's the next step there? Any guesses?
from our population control.
How do we take torture to the next level? Since we've already basically accepted that they do torture people, how do we take it to the next level? What's the unthinkable aspect? Yes, I can see the wheels are turning there. The wheels of your mind are turning. You're getting there. Take it to the next level.
Unfortunately, a bit slowly.
You've accepted, you've kind of grudgingly accepted torture, haven't you? But there's some aspect of that that you probably still put in that unthinkable area.
No, you've lost me.
Okay, here we go. I won't tell you. I'll play the clip from you and you'll find out.
He needs a little break.
For God's sake, we have no time.
Well, what do you think I should do, Helen?
Oh, you son of a bitch. What do you want me to say? Just do what you have to do.
What I have to do, Agent Brody, is... unthinkable. Bring me the children.
Jesus.
Give me the children. I'll give you the answers you want. Just bring them in.
I'm not doing that.
Just let him see them. Let him see them with me.
No. Over my dead body.
Kids are right outside.
No.
You just don't get it, do you?
You are not going to hurt those children.
Do you think I would?
Yes.
Good. Then so will he.
It's all been leading up to this. He has to believe H will do anything.
Look. All you have to do is bring them in, take them in the room, and strap them down. That's it.
No.
I won't harm them. I give you my word. But he has to believe I will. Then he will tell us anything we want.
Right. Right. I'll do it.
If you hurt those children, I will kill you.
Fine, Agent Brody. As if we don't all die from an explosion first.
Jesus fucking...
Okay, that's enough. This is a really nasty film, folks. There's really no excuse for this film. It's worse than any kind of slasher horror film that I've ever seen. Not because it actually has a lot of graphic violence in it, because of the theme of it. And interestingly, the last time you came on board, Lawrence, we were talking about themes of torture and degradation, and this film really is so much more hideous, I think, than anything that that we talked about on that occasion and anything that I've seen. Because, as you saw there in that scene, I was blocking the screen from you, unfortunately. Sorry about that. But the guy, who's the the terrorist there, who incidentally is white, and that's a very important point here to bear in mind, because we've increasingly seen this shifting of the focus of the threat of terrorism from the classic sort of brown-skinned Muslim to a white, you know, white people. And of course he's a Muslim in the story, but he's a white Muslim. But just to get back to what I was saying, what we see here is that this is towards the end of the film, and they've been trying to get this information out of him about the ticking time bomb, right? And they've tried all the they've done a lot of really nasty stuff to him. Like already, they chopped his fingers off. They pulled his fingernails out. They drilled his teeth with like drills, and that was all, you know, graphically shown to some extent, not in detail, but you know as a viewer quite clearly what they're doing. And they show you chopping his fingers off, right? So they've already demonstrated in the film that the torture is real, that they're really doing it, right? And then, but they're not getting the information that they require, and the bombs are going to go off, right? So the last thing that this interrogator can think of doing is torturing the kids. Of course, it's an obvious choice, isn't it? Yes. And you'll notice there when they bring the kids in and they strap the kids down, and they, in the film, of course, they don't actually torture the kids. Oh, how nice! You know, whoop-de-doo. Nice, yeah. And they claim that they're not going to torture the kids, but as that plays out, there's some doubt as to whether the guy is actually going to do it anyway, because. You can watch the film, but you know, basically, it gets more disgusting as it goes forwards. But what you just saw there is that when they put the kids in, strapped in the seats in the torture chamber, the guy immediately starts giving them the information they want. He gives them specific addresses, specific information. So. Despite the fact that they coat this film in saying, oh, it's terrible, it's unthinkable, and the interrogators are saying, you know, how dare you do this, they're letting it happen, and they're showing you that, yes, that's how we get the information, because the guy does actually cough up the information. And what actually does get interesting is that the interrogator, the bad interrogator played by Samuel L. Jackson, wants to go further, and he wants to really torture the kids, right? But they don't let him. And there's a kicker to it, because they do discover the bombs, but they don't discover all of the bombs. And that's because...
By justifying him.
That's because they didn't go right through with it. That's a clear message from the film. But of course, it's bullshit, folks. It's total bullshit. It's a Hollywood fantasy nonsense, right?
Yes.
Because if... It's all based on the proposition that you have a guy there that knows something that you don't know.
Yes.
And because he won't tell you what it is you don't know, you've got to force him to tell you. But whatever he tells you, you won't know if that's true either, because you don't know the truth.
Yes, that's right.
So there might be one bomb, there might be three bombs, there might be 10 bombs. He might tell you there's two bombs, but then there's another three bombs that he didn't tell you about. And... So the basic idea behind it is so flawed, but the movie actually, to the average viewer, will convey the justification for torture, because it's always a situation where there's a nuclear bomb and it's going to kill like a million people, right? So we just got to torture these two kids, right, to save a million people. And the average viewer will go, yeah, okay, you know, I can do the math. And unfortunately, it's bullshit. It's a lie. Because A, that situation has never happened in real life. B, if it did happen, you wouldn't get the information you wanted. You wouldn't have any way of knowing whether you had the real information. You know, you could keep torturing and you could keep torturing. In reality, torture has, for thousands of years, always been used for one thing and one thing only, confessions, okay? Torture is an excellent way of getting a confession from someone. Because, indeed, a person who is being tortured will say pretty much whatever. They'll get to a point, you know, that they're breaking point, and they'll say whatever you want them to say.
That's right.
So if you want them to confess to a crime, it's great. It's great for that. But if you want to get valid information, useful information, accurate information, and all of your top FBI interrogators have said this, and that there's great material out there on the internet that you can Google for, the best interrogators have said this, that you do not get good information from torturing people.
That's
torture
right.
is not for that purpose. It serves a different purpose. It serves a political purpose.
That's absolutely right. You hear that, you know, time and again about the last 10 years since that policy has been used in Iraq and etc. That there's a huge, you know, collateral damage from doing that, and yet it persists. So, you know, it's not as though they say, well, we've tried it now, and we always wanted to try it, and now we've tried it, but it doesn't work. No, it's more something wider spread, you'd think, than that, wouldn't you? It's a manifestation of something else, not the results. It's not a manifestation of the results, you know.
It appears to be
results haven't been great, and yet why is this tack still being taken?
Yeah. And one suspects that the script writers of these Hollywood films are getting cues or ideas from sources that we don't know about. There's been so many of these films now that feature torture, and also television shows like 24 with this character that goes around torturing people, and even Bill Clinton is quoted as saying that he thought that was pretty cool, the way that guy, you know, is a tough guy, he gets his information, you know. So it's been injected into our culture now since 9/11 as something that's acceptable. But what I see with this film is they want to take it to the next level. They want to bring into your consciousness the concept of torturing kids, and that's not happened before.
Yeah, that's right. It's this thing about bringing something into the familiar.
Into the discussion, yeah.
That's right. Like, we were talking about it last time, about the media shows involving dead people being examined forensically had become a theme since the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And then torture has become, you know, the theme, something that's acceptable, just as the whole terrorism thing has become the thing about the, you know, the first 10 years of this century. It's just become part of the discussion, as you said. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Now, look, we need to move on. It's been a bit of a feast of media tonight. We've been playing a whole lot of clips. I've got one more clip I want to play of another comedian, and we'll play that. And then we'll move into the second half of the show with Lawrence leading the way there. I just want to play this clip from George Carlin, a really interesting comedian. Again, a guy who really just he's right on the knife edge there between just being an outright political, you know, commentator and quite a savage one. This is quite a remarkable little spiel he gives. And I'm not sure when this was recorded. Anyway, we'll just kick it off for you here.
There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back. So they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they used to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue dick that's being jammed up their assholes every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it.
Okay. Yeah, there we have it. Yeah, great. I don't know, is that humor or is that just like political... diatribe.
Yeah, that's right. It was pretty well crafted. Yeah,
indeed. Okay, look, we're gonna just take a pause now and we'll be back with a musical journey. Please stand by.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back to the show. Well, in this half of the show, we're going to relax a bit. We're going to mellow out. I've got Lawrence here who's... I'm going to basically take a back seat and Lawrence is going to drive us on a journey. I think we're starting somewhere in the Caribbean. Is that right, Lawrence?
Yeah, that's right, Herwood. That's right. It's a... somewhere in the Caribbean is a good place to start for a musical journey at any time, given that area's rich musical contribution. And the tune I wanted to start with, just to jump straight into it...
Absolutely.
...is a tune called Starlag 17, which...
Okay.
Yeah.
This is from an album called Rocksteady.
That's right. This version is from Rocksteady. It's actually got a long history, this story. When I say story, I mean this rhythm. What I wanted to do tonight was to play a few iconic pieces of music by, as it turns out, black artists.
Terrific.
These artists, you know, the music they make has been part of the evolution of of world consciousness, really.
And so is that the unifying theme of what you're bringing to us tonight?
Yeah, that's right.
World consciousness?
Well, yeah. When we look at music and art and you see how that has been part of world consciousness, then, you know, it's interesting to kind of note a few real diamonds and real, real milestones on the way. And that's really why I'm playing these few tunes tonight.
So if I may just hint, we're talking about something more than just, amusement, music, you know, kind of like, we're not talking Kylie Minogue here.
We're not talking Kylie Minogue.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be a good introduction to the theme here.
Yeah. This is music that's kind of given people a sense of identity. We're talking black mostly, right?
Yeah, this selection here is black.
Okay.
And that's right, the sense of identity. What I'm interested in and what I guess people respond to is the fact that this is coming out of a community, this music's coming out of an identity that's not necessarily an individual one, not just an individual one. It seems to be something deeper than that, and people respond to it that way.
Great. We might have to do a show on Kylie Minogue.
Yeah, we'll do a full maybe. Justice.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, here we go. Starlike 17 from the album Rocksteady. Circa, what's the date of this?
I'd just like roughly? To give a couple of a bit of introduction to this tune because it is an icon. Yeah. Just briefly, it has been said that this tune, Starlike 17, is a strong contender for the most popular rhythm in reggae history. It has reportedly been versioned in over 400 tunes. So versioning is a part of the reggae genre in that you take a tune and put your own spin on it, and that has been there from the start. This is part of this idea of cultural history that, you know, it's part of the genre that you take a recognized tune and play it again, maybe on the B-side, and call it a version. And on that side, you might toast over the top of it. You use different instrumental section. You use different tracks altogether. Now, the most popular Starlike versions are probably the two massively popular early individual tunes. The first, which were done by Sister Nancy and Tenor Saw. But it's been used by a lot of diverse artists. It was originally cut by Ansel Collins, who's a legendary keyboardist, in 1973. So since that stage, since that year, it's been played, as you can see, a lot. So let's take it away.
What's the year of this album? When was this done?
This album, I believe, is in the much later than that. When these artists cut this album, by the way, both of these artists are legendary in reggae. Ernest Ranglin himself, the guitar player, has played on probably, you know, so many, uncountable number of reggae records. When he cut this album, he was 59 and the keyboardist was 71. So keep that in mind.
So this is from the late 60s, is it?
No, this album, no. They have been playing since the late 50s, these two, but this album, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure. Somewhere in the 90s.
Okay, so it's not that old. Okay, interesting.
It's not that old.
Okay,
no.
Thanks a lot. Let's go for it. was Starlog 17.
That was Starlog 17, played by the inventor of Scar, Ernest Ranglin, and Monty Montgomery in their late middle age, if not later. And so you can hear there the seasoned musicianship.
Can you define Scar for our audience? Because this, I don't know what it is myself. I've heard it, I've heard the term used.
Well, yeah, very good question. Since we're saying that he invented it, so it was a musical form native to Jamaica from the late 50s, a musical genre that originated there and was the precursor of rock steady, which then later became reggae. So it was.
Okay.
A version of the an island take on what was happening on the mainland state in the United States musically at that time, if you like. They kind of took the R&B feel but shifted the beat back from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 in the beat, if you like.
Can I just do a bit of dot connecting here?
Sure.
Look. When you talked about ska, rocksteady, reggae, and one immediately thinks Bob Marley, right? Now,
right.
But one thing about Bob Marley is that his music, and what we just listened to there was a very smooth, very very chic, very
almost elderly.
Very well, I wouldn't use that terminology. It was very smooth though, very smooth. Cultured, sophisticated, but what we saw with ska and then reggae was that it became very it entered the genre of almost like a form of folk music in its sort of emphasis on social issues and social justice. And a struggle, you know, like the fact that there is a struggle going on. Whereas there's this whole other trend in this type of music, and of course in jazz and in blues, where it's really just music for the music's sake. Now, you know, I'm just trying to draw a distinction here, and I'm not trying to judge, but there's a big kind of divide between music that is like. Very clearly has a goal or you know a purpose in mind for a struggle of some kind of humanity, and then there's kind of like the refined music for music's sake kind of thread.
Right. Well, when we listen to that song Starlog 17, you got as I said, I don't want to keep coming back to that. They were older when they played that tune, and they must have played it literally many thousands of times.
Indeed.
So it gives the impression, you know, for them, it's going to sound smooth. Just for that reason, they're not concert musicians or anything. That these guys play folk tunes, play these popular tunes for a living for many many years, and in fact inventing genres. Many many versions of this are going to be rough that you hear of that particular song we heard. This happens to be the way they played it for this track for this album, but they can play that any different way you'd like and. The lyrics for a lot of that early stuff was would be directly related to oppressed people. No, it would be.
So there are actually there is a song.
Well, I'm not aware of lyrics for that particular number. Although right. You see, that's the thing about versioning. This song has had 400 versions, which means that probably. A good number of those had lyrics applied to them, which could be anything, from the light to the extremely agitated and political.
Okay, well, thanks for that. So let's move on with the next piece you'd like to play
right.
us here.
Well, we're moving on to an artist called Lee Perry. Now, as I say tonight, I'm not. Trying to do a history or anything. I'm just trying to play a few icons of their field, of their genre. And Lee Perry is one of them. He, again, like Ernest Ranglin, has been there from the beginning. Whereas Ernest Langlin has credited with helping to invent the ska form, which later gave rise to rocksteady and reggae, Lee Perry came about probably about 10 years later and definitely had a big hand in developing the sound, which is now called reggae. Anyone who's seen him on YouTube or, you know, seen him in person will understand that why he's been called eccentric, because he is, apart from, you know, his incredibly prodigious and inventive style and record, is eccentric in his behavior. So he's always amusing to watch. Now he's quite old now, like all these guys, but you know, he was around for all that Bob Marley period, and as I said, it came and sort of made that form before Bob Marley got into the picture. So let's see. Even that, a lot of the titles of his songs are original, and he comes across as a sort of a visionary, really. Now, and a lot of the effects, he invented a lot of the studio techniques which have then were passed into general use on the mainland of America for decades, and helped to develop that hip hop and the DJ style and the scratching and all that kind of stuff. In fact, they call him Lee Scratch Perry is his name, because he was so inventive in the studio and passed on so many techniques and approaches. So you'll hear that in any lyric, any song you hear, there's this element of surprise, there's this element of the madcap, almost slapstick, which is kind of part of that Ireland aesthetic, I think, you see. You know, you hear that with this early Jamaican music. There's this sort of, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but happy-go-lucky. But there's something deeper to that happy-go-lucky, if you like. Now,
excellent.
Let's hit the number one there, which is called Bag of Collie. Dillinger, who was a famous songwriter from Jamaica.
So it's not the gangster, not...
No, but okay. Obviously probably named after him.
Right.
And Bag of Collie, Collie is marijuana, of course, and plays a big part in Jamaican in life, Jamaican musical culture.
It does indeed, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Bag of Collie, okay, by Dillinger.
No, by Dillinger, but obviously produced by Lee Perry, the great producer of reggae.
And roughly, what's the date of this piece?
Again, a good point, but probably the 60s or 70s.
Okay, that's good enough for
me. I'll date that for you after the track.
Excellent.
Right now I'm coming from the valley. Traveling mommy's good trolley. And I'm going to the Muhammad Ali. I and I break into Jalun Valley with a big bag of Cali. But you got to be officially, you know. As I would say, this yard dub and a coke white dub, rub it through the bum, through the bum. I tied dub, rubbing to the edge of the bomb. This ya dub, a naughty head, bongo dread, a naughty dread. Girl, out of the swills I will say, this ya dub. Stop on out your gas. Cause right now we are top of trash, you know. But listen to I. Sink your brakes. My mistake. Sink your gas and step by your clutch. You get this music real flush. You got the hole on your brush. You got the leg of this a one, yeah. And then you hold that the one day. Cause this a one, yeah, a pass. Make you rub so fast. Uh.
bang, to bang. But if you can't do the butter scam, you can't stand in this physical wrong. Just stand on the bank and watch man scam. Watch them. Keep on scamming, but don't scam on the bank. If you scam on the bank, from a scam, a scam. If a power make a show up every hour and hour, forward ever, backward for Trevor. I will never, 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 never play back. I won't do that, cause that is wrong. Move onward and not backward. Because you'll never come to a musical game. Just have some fight. I like the way you operate, and that I will appreciate. I don't like your ways at all, because you make me and so
yeah, so that track was from 1978. So
okay.
Yeah, it was showed a lot of the trademark characteristics of a Lee Perry track of that period and earlier. A lot of those are innovations. You might have heard the guitar accompaniment there, which the two types of guitar. One was the sort of regular keeping of the beat, a skanking sort of a sound, and the other was a bubbling, which was a muted picking of the bass strings. The use of the vocals was highly innovative itself, and just the general structure of the track was just characteristic. You know, was a very original and just something typical of Lee Perry. There's something of the, I said the madcap before, but you know what I mean. It was highly idiosyncratic, I think, and many other people.
Interesting. Yeah. So the idiosyncratic nature of the music, and this Lee Perry was from Jamaica.
That's right, Jamaica.
Correct. And was there a pretty rich musical culture in Jamaica at that time?
Yeah, from what I know, there were many
musical genres in all of that sort of South American, Central American, and Caribbean area. In fact,
quite distinct from Cuba, yeah. Though, and you know, it's very distinct, isn't it? I mean, the Cuban music and the Latin American music is a very definite genre, one which I love too. I know so little about it, and it's shocking, really, how little that I do know about it. And well, I'm sure that there's all kinds of great, you know, geniuses there and great stars that have come and gone that we've barely known about. I mean, we found out about the Buena Vista Social Club only because of a movie, and they became quite famous. And you know, there was so much there about Cuban music that was like huge for those people in that part of the world. And I mean, we found about reggae because of Bob Marley, but of course then there are all these other great, you know, great people, and reggae is still a really powerful musical genre today, still, isn't it?
Well, that's it. It's interesting about reggae that it has persisted, not only in its own form, but those influences of Lee Perry, went into the States, United States, and influenced so much of that black music since then. But on the genre thing, yeah, in the Central American Caribbean, every island in every area has its, or did at the time, I don't know about now, I suppose everything's changed, I mean, changed form, but these kind of, you know, it was like a dialect. So there were so many different forms of the folk music, and that's what that area seems to have produced, so much music.
Terrific. So what's up next?
Well, I thought I'd change genre again, since we're into the genre-changing type of thing, and this is Buddy Guy. Now, I'm sure all, you know, that your listeners of a certain age and maybe more will have heard of Buddy Guy. Eric Clapton, who also your listeners might have heard of, has said that he is the, you know, greatest blues player. He, again, is an elder musician these days because he was born in 1936. Apparently he began learning guitar on a two-string diddly bow that he made. So he's like the last surviving blues man, original blues man. I mean, when I say surviving, obviously he's the most famous, and who knows who's surviving. But in terms of recognition, in terms of history, in terms of track record, in terms of quality, in terms of originality, etc., Buddy Guy is probably the reigning, you know, he's the icon as far as blues go. He's the connection not only of the South to Chicago, where Chicago blues got its, you know, origins, but to the modern era. So, you know, you listen to him, you're listening to a lot of history and quality.
Awesome. So which track would you like to play for us from this Smoking at the Half Note? Oh, we've got the wrong CD loaded. We'll just eject that. And
where is it? This one here.
Okay, we'll just quickly.
There's only one track for Bonnie there. Now, Buddy Guy is a very intense player. I saw him at the Enmore Theatre, and he's a great showman too. And during the show, he walked out in the middle of the show, up through the crowd, probably took about 10 minutes, just never dropping a beat and never dropping intensity while the band continued to play, more or less meandered through the crowd and let them gather around him, and then out onto the street and played to the passing taxis, and then back onto the stage. And managed to pull all that off. But whenever you listen to one of his tracks, you feel there is so much talent, for one thing, and intensity and music.
The first time I met the blues, if you know, I was walking down through the woods. Yeah, so soon. Yeah, I should know you'll be with me every morning. Yeah, every night.
a pretty mean song.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty mean. He's really squeezing those that guitar fretboard through that song.
He was putting it through its paces, was he? Really fingering up.
Yeah.
All the way.
What was interesting about the way he played compared to the way they play now is that he wasn't afraid to play set riffs over and over and make slight variations of them, whereas these days blues has got a bit slacker. But there you're listening to the tight kind of playing that would have been, you know, standard way of rendering a blues back in those days, which is that you have a certain riff and you repeat it, and it gives it a great intensity.
So we've become a little loose, have we?
Lacking in intensity, I think. Well, people can screw their face up and
indeed.
It's like act as though they're intense. But when you hear the intensity of that, I think there's a big difference. Yeah.
I respect what you're saying there. Look, we're going to have to wind up the show, unfortunately, Lawrence, pretty shortly here. But we can do one more track.
One more track. Well, we're going to take a big jump if we do that.
Well, let's choose whatever you'd like to go next.
I've got it. Sure. Well, the this track is
the incredible jazz guitar
of Wes Montgomery. Now, so of course, it's another great leap in musical style. Wes Montgomery has
we're good at handling leaps here at Truth News.
Well, yeah, that's right. We're very deft and we're very nimble, because Wes Montgomery has been called the greatest jazz guitarist. And
what did we skip over, by the way, just so that we know what we missed?
Well, great leaps of history and
right.
And geography and all the rest.
But we started off in the 90s, so I'm going on dates and times, because like the first thing we listened to was then we backtracked and then we're coming forward again.
Well, this track dates from about 64.
Okay, well we're staying back there.
Yeah, really.
We're back there. Yeah,
the last three tracks have been back there. They
so that first track you played for us was like a warm up flashback of the guys in their later life.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
That's right.
Interesting approach.
Heyday.
Yeah, yeah. I like your I like your style.
Yeah, because this is
it's sneaky.
We're looking back, and now Wes Montgomery has been called the greatest jazz guitar player, and now he's a very interesting case is Wes, because he is in many ways not typical as a musician, except that he's one of the greatest. He couldn't read music, and yet you will not hear of, or you will not know of a greater musical ear than Wes's. He was a storyteller. He had a unique technique, and he was an innovator, and he was a consummate craftsman. Now, this song was one of the ones that made him famous at that time. He had been playing in obscurity for probably a couple of decades before that, because he was a very unassuming man who had a large family that he supported as a machinist, and playing only at nights. So he for decades he seemed to have got by with a couple of hours of sleep. And he was a heavy smoker, and he died young in 1968. And this song was recorded. This song called West Coast Blues was one that was on the album The Incredible Jazz of Guitar, and it shows his ability to build a solo, which is often something in jazz that is looked on as a weak point. A lot of jazz musicians can play a solo of a chorus, which is one time through the song or two. But to be able to build like this guy does and actually invent a composition on the fly with all the thoroughness and quality of a composition, then that's quite unique. And he has a name as being someone who, almost by listening to it, you educate yourself about what jazz might be, or especially of that period, because it's changed a lot since then.
Without further ado, West Coast Blues. Okay, well, that, you know, to enjoy that properly, I feel like I need to have a cigar in my hand and a pretty lady by my side.
That's right.
It's a really elegant piece of music there. Was that recorded live?
No, it was a studio recording, that, but you got to remember, at that time, this was unheard of. I mean, to us, it sounds, you know, part of distant history. But when you listen to this old stuff, you've got to remember that it had its time and it had its place, and it was breaking ground in ways that we probably don't know these days. You know, that's what it's like, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's different. Every era is different. People expect different things. You know, look, music is just an incredibly rich environment. Like, it's a journey. You know, we have to. And I'd like to do more on Truth News with music. And I'd like to have the time to be able to actually step through, because I think a lot of